The deputy who was accused of hiding during the Parkland shooting is behind bars.
And the Carnival Corporation pays a hefty fine for polluting.
Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez with WLRN reporter Danny Rivero.
Today we'll get an update on the arrest of former Broward Sheriff Deputy Scott Peterson. He faces numerous charges. Also, a $20 million fine was imposed on Carnival Corporation for years of throwing oily waste into the ocean.
And we'll meet Coconut Grove resident John Pardoe, who was shot and paralyzed years ago when living in Venezuela. He's taken the famous pilgrimage El Camino de Santiago and made a documentary of it. He's also competing on MasterChef Latino. And finally, summer shorts are back at the Arsh. You can expect some plays that will challenge the way you view controversial subjects. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
And I'm Danny Rivero, co-hosting today.
Well, yesterday, former Broward County Sheriff's Deputy Scott Peterson was arrested and booked into a Broward County jail. Peterson was charged with 7 counts of neglect of a child, 3 counts of culpable negligence, and 1 count of perjury.
Peterson had been chastised by members of the commission for his inaction during the shooting. He was formally fired from the department by Broward County Sheriff Gregory Tony on Tuesday.
Our Broward County reporter, Katie Switalski, was at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission meeting when Peterson's arrest was announced, and that's where she is now. She joins us for the second day of those meetings. Katie, great to have you.
Hi, Lewis and Danny. Thanks for having me.
All right, so take us to the announcement yesterday at the commission meeting. What was the atmosphere? How did folks respond to that news?
It was pretty odd because the announcement interrupted a panel that the commissioners were talking about mental health services in Broward County schools. And so the commission's chair, Bob Gualtieri, basically said, we're going to pause for a minute. There's been a media alert. Peterson has been arrested. And some of the family members of victims still attend every single one of these commission meetings, and they're in the audience. And there was this audible cheering from a few of them, this atmosphere of yes, some sort of feeling that justice had been served to an extent.
And Kenny, can you remind us of who Scott Peterson is and what is his involvement in the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School?
Yeah, he's the former school resource officer at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, actually. He was there for several years. He would have known the kids. He would have known the school very well. And on the day of the shooting, he was heavily criticized for not going into the 1200 building where the shooting was taking place. On surveillance video, you can actually see him hiding behind a pole or, you know, waiting outside and actively not going in the building, which he was very heavily criticized for.
So what was the argument made by the FDLE, Katie, for why he should be arrested? Why now?
So there's been this long investigation. FDLE has been investigating the law enforcement response to the shooting. And in their investigation, basically they believe that Peterson's inaction is directly correlated to loss of life. And so while it's really unusual for a law enforcement officer to be charged criminally for something he didn't do instead of something he did do, FDLE felt in this case they could directly connect, you know, his standing still to loss of people's lives.
And what have we heard from Peterson's defense attorney at this point, the defense attorney Joseph DeRuzzo, regarding his arrest and the charges that his inaction contributed to the loss of life?
See, and I'm glad you asked because, Peterson maintains and his attorney has maintained, especially yesterday, that this is politically motivated and this is some sort of retribution in trying to make Peterson, you know, some sort of quote unquote scapegoat for the entire shooting when, you know, as Peterson's attorney points out, there's only one real person to blame for all of this, the confessed shooter himself.
We're speaking with WLRN's Broward County reporter, Katie Switalski, joining us from outside the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission meeting. Yesterday, former Broward County Sheriff Deputy Scott Peterson was arrested on multiple charges for his inaction during the Parkland shooting in February of 2018. So, Katie, you've been covering these Public Safety Commission meetings for over a year now. How much has Peterson come up as a critical person and a focal point in this investigation?
The entire time. The commission is charged with looking into what exactly happened on that day, and Peterson's a big part of it, because when they're looking at lives lost on the third floor, six people died and four people were injured in the time that Peterson was idle. And so over the course of more than a year now, the commission has been trying to talk to Peterson. He last November did not come and testify to the commission, which was seen as a large sign of cowardice. And the commission has really been looking at him this entire time. He's an outlier. They do recognize that a lot of the law enforcement that day that did go in and try to stop the shooting, they should not be measured by Peterson, but Peterson himself has been a critical part of this investigation.
And in addition to the kind of the cheers that you heard erupting from the crowd, did you hear from any of the family members of people who were victims of this attack?
Yeah, I got to talk to Max Schachter yesterday. He's one of the commissioners, but he also lost his son Alex in the shooting, and he was. Visually relieved. I mean, he basically said, I never thought that he would be charged, and this is a start for justice. I mean, it's something that the families have really been pushing for as a unified group, because they want to see some things change. They want to see some things being done. And this was something that, multiple family members yesterday, including, Max Schachter, were, happy to say that they were happy about.
Katie, have we heard from Broward County Sheriff Gregory Tony?
So we have in a statement, and in the statement, the sheriff basically says, inaction is inexcusable, and he was fired. Now, Peterson had already resigned shortly after the shooting, so this is like a formal, a much more formal termination.
And what's the next step? What happens now? Because my understanding is Peterson's still in custody, right?
He is still in custody. He did not post bail this morning. There's some sort of issue with his passport. And so the next steps... I'm actually not 100% sure. I don't have that in front of me, but I do know that he is still in custody. He may post out on bail if those passport issues get resolved, but people aren't sure yet. And even if he did get released, he would have to wear a constant GPS.
We've been talking with WLRN's Broward County reporter Katie Switalski. Again, she's at the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission meeting. This is day two of those meetings. Yesterday, Broward County Sheriff Deputy Scott Peterson was arrested on multiple charges for his inaction during the Parkland shooting in February of 2018. He is a former deputy, by the way.
Still to come, Carnival Cruises is paying $20 million in fines for dumping oil into the ocean. We'll explain that and a controversy surrounding Port Miami next on Sundial. Welcome back. You're listening to Sundial. I'm Danny Rivero. Carnival Corporation agreed to cut its disposable plastic use in half across its entire fleet by 2021. This came after the company pleaded guilty Monday at a Miami federal court to six probation violations. The violations all related to illegal dumping of oil and sewage in the Bahamas. It's not the first time the Miami-based cruise line giant violated environmental rules. Under Monday's deal in court, the company also agreed to pay a criminal penalty of $20 million for the environmental violations. WLRN's environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich joins us to give us an update on this story. She'll also explain later why the Port of Miami could be in trouble for serious damage to the coral reefs. Welcome, Jenny.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Danny.
So, Jenny, this isn't the first time Carnival has violated environmental pollution rules. When else was the company doing this?
So this started in 2016. They had a whistleblower case who reported that they were dumping waste fuel overseas or into the ocean overseas. It was off, I believe, the English coast. So that sort of started this federal case against them. And as part of that deal, they pleaded guilty and they were sentenced to probation for 5 years. And that probation included monitoring and oversight, surprise audits to ships. And that led us to this hearing this week in court.
And what was it specifically that that they were found in violation of.
So over the during the probation, they were found to be dumping food waste, plastics overboard. They didn't have proper monitoring of that. They were supposed to put into a compliance program to make sure they cleaned up their pollution and abided by laws. And what the auditors and the court ordered monitors found was that they had in fact not done that. And the federal judge on the case was pretty angry about it.
So all 12 members of the Carnival Corporation's board of directors were ordered to attend Monday's hearing. That included Mickey Arison, of course, the owner of the Miami Heat. What was the how did that play out?
Well, it was quite a sight to see four rows of cruise line executives lined up in court, most men, most in suits, and to be sitting there and basically being scolded not just by Judge Seitz, but she when she retires, she plans to hand off the case to Judge Ungaro. So it was sort of unusual to see two federal judges on the bench at once, both asking very pointed questions. I think that. Part of the original crime, Carnival was also forced to pay $40 million in fines, which seems like a lot. But the judges, when they talked about the case this week, were kind of stunned that Carnival hadn't taken to heart some of the things that they had asked to be done. And in addition to having to cut their plastic use in half, they also were fined an additional $20 million. But Judge Ungaro seemed to suggest that was kind of chump change for such a huge cruise line.
And how significant is that cutting the plastics in half for the fleet? How big is the fleet that they have?
They have 100+ ships. So after this, I was looking around to see what other cruise lines had cut plastics. Norwegians has no longer uses straws. Carnival, I think, doesn't use straws on some of their cruise lines. But to eliminate all half of all their plastic, disposable plastics, these are single-use plastics, we don't know how much it is. I asked Mickey Arison afterwards, who declined to comment, and deferred questions to his spokesman, who couldn't estimate either the amount of plastics or the cost to the company.
I'm speaking with Jenny Stiletovich. She's the environment reporter here at WLRN, and we've been talking about Carnival Cruise Lines. The company was at federal court on Monday and pled guilty to environmental violations. Moving on to another story, a recent study by the University of Miami found that over 500,000 coral reefs in Florida were destroyed by the Port of Miami dredging. Jenny talked to the leading researcher of the study and environmental activists. Jenny, the connection between the dredging and the damage to the coral reefs it's been a pretty debated topic for quite a while now. Remind us of what's happened here.
That's right. So in 2013, the Corps launched this expansion at Port Miami to deepen the channel to make way for these massive ships coming through the expanded port of Panama, the Panama Canal. And they were going to deepen the channel by 6 feet. That involved scooping out tons and tons of sediment and rock and putting it on barges and taking it offshore. That created plumes of sediment that settled over the reef track, the inshore reef track, the outer reef. The Corps, when it got permits to do this work, said that it might damage some coral. Some of them were protected coral. That meant that if they damaged those coral, they were going to have to make up for the damage they caused. They said in their findings that they had just damaged a small amount. They said 6 colonies, according to their consultant. UM stepped back in and they said, no, it's more like 500,000 colonies of coral.
That sounds like a lot. The damaged corals, were those corals that were specifically in government cut, kind of where the dredging was happening, or were these corals that were further out?
These were in the channel and where the channel was widened. Most of the damage was done around the channel widening, the reef tract. But the channel crosses the reef tract. And so this is, I think people may not realize that this is the only inshore reef tract in the U.S. And right now it's also being hit by another disease outbreak. So it's under a lot of stress and a lot of eyes are on it because provides a valuable barrier to storm surge and hurricanes. A recent study put the value at about $650 million a year in flood protection during a severe storm. That can be as much as $1.6 billion.
So you talked to the lead researcher, Andrew Baker. Let's take a listen to what he said on their findings.
We found, however, that you couldn't explain the loss of corals through the disease alone, because many of the corals were lost were of species that were not susceptible to the disease in the first place. And also we found that corals that were closer to the dredge channel were much, much more likely to be lost and die than corals further away. The notion that only six corals died as a result of dredging is actually sort of absurd given the impacts and the amount of sediment that was there. And so I'm just happy that we were able to get hold of the data so that we could actually interpret it properly.
So Andrew's been studying coral for some time now, looking in particular at that it might be more resilient to
right.
climate change. What is that?
Right. So he was actually very interested in the coral in the channel because they are more resilient. They grow in a really inhospitable place. The channel has a really strong current washing in and out. It's cloudy a lot of times. So when this all started, he wanted to go in and rescue some of those corals so he could examine them and figure out, like, why are these guys so much more resilient to these conditions than other corals? I forgot your question.
Andrew had been studying one particular coral that seems like it might be more resilient to climate change.
Right.
Like, is there an explanation for that?
Well, that's what he's looking at, is what makes these corals particularly more resilient. Coral feed, they live, they have a symbiotic relationship with algae. Some algae are better at surviving higher ocean temperatures and acidity. And he wants to figure out why that is. And if you can figure that out, when we go to restore reefs, you can plant those coral there instead of other coral that might just end up dying again.
They'd live better.
They'd do better at surviving.
Got it. So a big part of this is a certain coral disease. What can you tell us about this coral disease?
Right. So in 2014, they first discovered this disease off Virginia Key. You know, the timing is curious because that's when the dredge started. So there is some question about, was the dredge work related to the stony coral disease? Scientists have not done enough research yet to tie those two things together. But this disease is now the longest and largest coral disease outbreak anywhere on record. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has put together an emergency team trying to address this outbreak. WLRN has reported on this. Nan Klingner in the Keys has written about or done stories about how it has now moved past the Keys and into the Marquesas. There's this big fear that if they don't figure out how to stop this or get a handle on it, it is going to continue to spread, and that could be a terrible thing for reefs in a lot of places.
Yeah. As far as the potential solutions that researchers and scientists have been looking into, what have they found so far, if they've found anything?
Well, right now they're doing sort of a Noah's Ark effort. They are taking coral that have not been affected yet, like down in the Marquesas, and taking them to places like UM, to Nova in Broward County, to, I believe, Moat, some places down in the Keys, and they're keeping these healthy coral. They're going to put them in zoos in different places around the country and try and keep them alive until they can figure out what's going on in this diseased area, which is unprecedented. Usually when they do coral restoration, you go to the reef to address the illness. Now they're taking healthy coral off the reef and putting them in a safe place until they can figure out what's going on with this disease.
Wow. So you talked to Rachel Silverstein. She's the executive director of Miami Waterkeeper and marine biologist at the University of Miami. And we have a clip from here.
A lot of people are surprised to learn that there's such a thriving reef community and ecosystem around what are industrial shipping channels. But the fact is that, you know, before this project, there was a thriving reef there, full of life. People have documented manta rays in the shipping channel, sharks, turtles, all sorts of fish congregate there in the Port Everglades shipping channel. So there's far-reaching effects, and I think that this study really highlighted exactly how deadly these projects can be if they're not properly controlled, and how far the impacts can go.
So it's not just reefs we're talking about as these kind of mostly still things that live in the water. there's a potential impact for other marine life here, is there?
Right. So well, first of all, there is more dredge work to be done. I think what the scientists and what Miami Waterkeeper want to raise attention about is Port Everglades. They're about to do dredge work at Port Everglades. They're also having to come back to Port Miami because they're finding that the channel is still too narrow for some of these massive ships. So they're considering going back in yet again and dredging Port Miami. There are the other wildlife that you mentioned that there could be impacts on. There was a dolphin die-off that occurred around 2015 in Biscayne Bay. It is the first dolphin mortality event, is like the official term that NOAA uses, ever recorded in Biscayne Bay, so that's significant. There has been seagrass dying off for the last decade, but they had a particularly big die-off in Tuttle Basin north of the port that they still don't know why that occurred. So these are vital parts of our ecosystem here in Biscayne Bay that a lot of people are worried about.
So there's one more point of the story. Last week, one of the key figures here, a biologist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, was charged with making a false statement to her bosses. Who is she, and what's her role in all of this?
That's right. So she worked for the Corps for many, many years, and she's a biologist and was sort of the point person for the coral. She was the person who was keeping track of the consultant who was monitoring the damage to the coral. Last week, the U.S. Attorney's Office charged her with lying about talks with a consultant over an outside job. It's not yet clear what exactly the details are in that. The federal court case has sort of a very short description, and the U.S. Corps, the Corps has not responded to my questions yet about that.
So we'll learn more in the coming weeks, I imagine.
Yes, I hope.
So we've been talking with WLRN environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich. You can find more of her reporting on these environmental issues at WLRN.org.
Still to come, we're going to meet John Pardo, a South Florida resident who is currently competing on MasterChef Latino. That's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Coconut Grove resident John Pardo years ago confronted a car thief. He got shot, and now he spends his life in a wheelchair. But that hasn't stopped him. He recently did the Camino de Santiago, a famous 800-kilometer, nearly 500-mile journey, crossing from France through Spain through rugged terrain. He documented his journey in the film I Did It My Way, which won several awards at film festivals across the country. Aside from his love for travel, Pardo also has a deep connection to food. His skills in the kitchen landed him a spot on MasterChef Latino, where he's become the first contestant on the program in a wheelchair. We spoke with Pardo about the origins of his culinary passion, his recovery from the shooting that left him paralyzed, and his journey on El Camino de Santiago.
I was very young. It was at the early age of maybe 5 years old. I'd love to see my mother and my grandmother cook. So I was always interested in cooking and the smells and food. And since I was very, very young, as a matter of fact, like for my birthday, I always asked my parents to take me to a restaurant. That was like, even when I was a little kid, I just loved food and loved to cook with my mother. And we had people in the house that would help, and I would cook with the help. And I would just, sometimes I would even skip school and pretend I was sick.
and they let you like, you know, work and work with them and help them with preparing food?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, when I was very young, my mother used to take me to the supermarket, and she used to let me pick the vegetables because I picked them ripe and I picked them how you would eat them. So since I was very young, they always let me. I would cook a full meal when I was 5, 6, or 7 years old. Yeah.
Wow.
I just loved cooking.
You were in law school, and this is when you had your incident. This is when you were shot while you were in law school?
Yeah, I was my third year in law school, and I was in Venezuela, and unfortunately I was in my house, and the security people from the building, they called me and they said that they were robbing my car. So I went out, you know, 21 years old, you know, full of testosterone, and you know, and you could, you know, you think you're on top of the world. And I just went out and I guess I confronted the thieves, and I was shot twice.
I wanted to know at the time,
what sort of medical treatment was available in Venezuela, the rehab and everything, you know, considering what had happened to you. You get shot twice and you find yourself paralyzed. But what in Venezuela, what was available?
Not much. We have very good doctors, but when in terms of rehabilitation, you know, they're not much. So I was in the hospital for like a month because I had my one of my arm was shot, so I had a lot of reconstructive surgery in my arm because of the gun wound. And so after I left the hospital, we decided to come to the U.S. and do rehab here.
What eventually brought you to Miami?
I'm from Caracas, so I love the sea. I love to be by the ocean. I can't be away from the ocean. I'm a water boy.
So. And so when you got here, I mean, at that point of your life, you know, you're this young man, but now you've got to get used to a very different type of life than you're used to. I mean, what was it like for you after you arrived here?
For me, adapting is just part of my life. And I came to Miami. I was close to my father lived in Venezuela. I was close to my mother who lived in Pennsylvania. And I was just right in the middle, so that was perfect. So, and, you know, it's Miami being a Latin community, it was pretty fairly easy for me to feel at home.
My understanding was you had a series of odd jobs, and I wondered, in throughout all of this, and in your recovery and getting adapting to this new life, how did you keep that passion for being in the kitchen?
Well, my kitchen evolved. Okay, so when I was very young, when I was 5 years old, I did it because I was just curious. And then when I moved to Pennsylvania, I lived with my grandmother and my uncle, which they're older. So I cooked for them. So that was also another evolution in my cooking because I had to learn how to not cook with a lot of salt and a lot of fat. And so I cooked for them. So my cooking evolved from being something intuitive to a necessity. And then when I was in Venezuela, I just realized that that's the way you get to a woman's heart is through food. So I realized that very quick. So I learned that at a very young age. And then I loved cooking for my girlfriends. And, you know, that was for me. And then just cooking evolved. So then I was shot and I was left in the chair. So I had a lot of time to be at home because I was still having problems with my arm. So I was like, what better time to just even cook even more? So I really refined my kitchen when I was, you know, due to the chair. I really, you know, because I had more time to do it.
It just seems like, because listening to you, that for you, family is important. But even for your cooking, family has always been an important part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Cooking for me, I have to be inspired for cooking. So it's very, I mean, I've always cooked for my family, for people that I love. So I think cooking is the ultimate expression of love because that's how that's how at least I do it. You know, I really dedicate this time for you to eat this. You know, it's like people ask me like, oh, did you just like to cook? And I'm like, no, if it wasn't for you, I'd eat pita chips and Nutella. I know I can cook, you know, I'm cooking for you. So yeah, I definitely cook for family members and loved ones and love to do that.
How did you end up on MasterChef Latino? How did that even come about?
I was doing exercise in one of my runs. I call them runs, but I'm rolling. I like to do a lot of exercise. And I just met a friend of mine, really good friend of mine, that he works in Key Biscayne. And he's like, he reminded me, he's like, oh, you know, you should sign up for MasterChef Latino. You're really good. You know, I told you last year to do it. You definitely should do it this year. So I was like, well, yeah, let me try it out.
What was the experience like? What's it like when you camera's rolling, it's a competition, judges, and look, because you make food, as you said, it's out of love.
Yeah.
This is different.
It's a difference. So you hit it right on the nail. Ever since I started this show, I thought it was going to be difficult, and that was going to be the most difficult part for me because I do cook for love. And I'm like, I have to be inspired of something because otherwise I won't be able to cook right. I mean, I have to be, something has to inspire me. So when I walked into the show, I'm like, okay, I need to find another inspiration because I'm not cooking for my girlfriend. I'm not cooking for my family. So I definitely found it really fast, you know, and my inspiration was myself, you know, and I just inspired myself and that's how I saw it. And I'm like, you know, just give it your best and come up with great dishes. You've been doing it for a long time. And it was just a self-inspiring moment. So it was very, very overwhelming to bring your dish in front of three judges. I was very nervous, very, very nervous.
I'm speaking with Coconut Grove resident John Pardo. Pardo is the first handicapped contestant to be on any MasterChef program. He's also featured in the documentary I Did It My Way, which chronicles his journey in a wheelchair along the 800 kilometers, which is roughly 500 miles, along the iconic Camino de Santiago. You can see a trailer of the film, by the way, on our social media, WLRN Sundial. This is a fascinating journey in Spain that people every year, they make the pilgrimage there to take this journey. Remind people real quickly of what that journey is like, not just, you know, for anybody, but for you, it was, well, because of your wheelchair, it was a lot harder.
Yeah, I've always wanted to do the Camino de Santiago, which is called The Way. I've always wanted to do it. It's always been in my mind to do something like that. Probably when I was 22 years old, I was already thinking about it. But I came in a crossroad in my life where I needed clarity. And, you know, it's one of those times that you say, okay, I got the time, I got the, you know, I got the strength, you know, let me do it. So I decided to do it, and it was actually very, very difficult. It was more difficult than I really thought. You start in France and Saint-Jean-Pied, the port that's on the other side of the Pyrenees Mountains. So just your first day, you're crossing the Pyrenees Mountains for the first 3 days with inclinations up to, 60 degrees. I mean, they're very tough.
You already do a lot of training anyway. Yeah. So, but did you have to do anything extra special to get ready for this? This is grueling.
Not really. Like, I train a lot. I train a week, like, four times a week. When I can, when I have time. But I was ready for it. But I guess nobody is really ready for the, maybe not the physical part of it, but the mental strength to hold up for that kind of a journey.
And a lot of people take this because for them, it's a spiritual journey.
Yes.
For you, what did that mean?
It was definitely a spiritual journey. I mean, I needed to find myself. You know, I think you find yourself through your life many times, and this was the time that I had to find myself again. So I did it, and you go in with thinking of something that you're doing it for a reason, and you come out with a total other, with another reason completely different than when you walked in. So that's what it does through the whole 30 days, 28 days that I took to do that. You know, your mind kind of organizes again. So you start with something that's very personal to you, and then you end up thinking, you know, I started with this and I came out with this. So it's a very beautiful spiritual experience, yeah.
You know, I wondered how many times throughout, and I'd read different people's stories about that journey. How many times did you find yourself thinking, I can't finish this?
How many times? I think one time.
Okay.
And that was only 100 kilometers before I came into Santiago. I got really sick, and I was urinating blood and everything, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm only 100 kilometers away from Santiago, and I'm getting this sick, and I had antibiotics, and I'm like, you know, like I just popped in like four antibiotics, and I had a really good friend of mine that I met in Santiago. He's like, John, let's just run these 100 kilometers. I'm with you. Let's just run them. So I'm like, you know, if the fever hits me, it's going to take 48 hours to hit me. So let's run. We got 2 days. So those past 2 days, we just really went through the 100 kilometers
and
really
fast. When it was over, then what?
When it was over, it was overwhelming, the experience. It was really overwhelming, the experience. And it's something that I really recommend anybody that has the chance to do it, you know, to do it. Experience, and I found myself in a lot of ways. I found myself in cooking. I found myself in you know, spiritually. I found myself correcting the way I want to conduct, you know, the rest of my life and the way I want to proceed the rest of my life. And that's why I documented this documentary. I just set a GoPro between my legs and documented the whole journey. And I came home and I was the executive producer of my documentary.
Whatever happens with MasterChef, what do you think you're going to do with this next? What do you want to do beyond this now?
I started this journey with MasterChef because I want to show the people that not only people that have a disability, just people that can just do it your way, and that's what my website's all about. You know, just to inspire. So MasterChef was just part of one of my journeys that I did on my new life. That's one of the things I really want to get out of MasterChef. And of course, you know, cooking and I love cooking, so let's see where that takes me. I may be my own program. I want to travel the world and learn about food all around the world. So maybe do some of that.
John, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for sharing, and Thanks so much.
No, thank you for having me here.
That was Coconut Grove resident John Pardo. He is the first contestant in a wheelchair on MasterChef Latino. You can watch episode 4 of this season. It's on Sunday on Telemundo. And, of course, we shared a link to John's website, I Did It My Way, on our social media, WLRN Sundial, where you can watch a trailer of his journey on El Camino de Santiago. Well, still to come, what does President Franklin Pierce have to do with slaying dragons? We head over to the Arts Center for this year's Summer Shorts Plays. That's coming up next on Sundial.
Each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Sexual harassment in the workplace remains a hot button issue in the era of Me Too, as many workplaces are reforming their policies and trainings. What could we learn from a sexual harassment workplace training intended for Vikings? Yeah, you heard that right. I did say that, Vikings. Well, that's the premise of one of 8 short plays being performed at this year's Summer Shorts production at the Adrian Arts Center running through June 23rd. This year's short plays tackle a wide variety of complex issues, things through humor, music, thrills, and some controversial. Joining me in studio now, two of the actors in this year's shorts, Brian Reif and Javon Jacobs. Brian, Javon, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Appreciate it. Also, the director of this year's shorts, Gladys Ramirez, also an actress. Gladys, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Let me start with this real quickly, because we do the summer shorts every year. This is a really fun program, but for people who haven't seen it, Gladys, how do you describe it?
Well, it's a series of short 10-minute plays, widely ranging from comedy to drama to musicals, and it's presented fast and furious. It's a really fun night.
All right. Now, you know what? In the promo before the segment, I talked about former President Franklin Pierce and dragon slaying, so I can't go without asking, what is that one about?
It's exactly what it sounds like, actually. Exactly. Without giving too much away, it's an interesting perspective into Franklin Pierce and what he's known for versus what he was really about.
All right. So that's a little tease just to get you guys going. The interesting thing about this for Brian and Javon is that, you know, these are short plays. You're not just one actor in a show. You're playing numerous parts. You're jumping around from bit to bit. What's that like as an actor? You can't focus on one part. You got to change costumes and change character. How's that? How do you do that, Javon?
I mean, it's really fun, actually. I mean, we're one actor, but we're playing multiple roles. Exactly. So, for me, I'm playing like 4 or 5 different roles, which is fun, but it's really exhausting as far as backstage, because we're running around, we're changing costume. It's exciting, though.
Okay, but you know, as I think about this, look, I'm not the actor, so I wouldn't know, but I'm just like, you know, I've seen actors who they have to work to get into character, and you're playing multiple characters.
Right. Well, I mean, these happen, and these characters, they have an arc of 10 minutes, so it's not a lot of, like, deep mental preparation that we have to go through, and it's a lot of fun and light. But
you don't have really time to think.
You don't want to get too deep.
So how do you? All right, so Brian, how do you do it?
I joke with my cast all the time backstage that I just kind of black out for 2 hours and just keep going, because you don't have time to stop. If you're not on stage, you're changing backstage, and you just keep going.
It's part of it.
All right, real quickly, I know that it's not fair to ask, because you know, it's almost like asking which child you love most, but. Brian, I'll start with you. What's your favorite show? Which is your favorite part?
Actually, the two that I'm in with Javon are my favorites. The Forgotten Place and Schrodinger's Gun.
They both are directed by our director.
Both directed
here.
By Gladys.
Gladys.
I like him because a lot of times with shorts, you know, you do the wild, zany comedies, and these ones really touch the heartstrings a bit more and really make you think about social issues, about relationships, about life challenges. So
they're substantial.
Yeah, they're really rewarding to do every day.
All right. This is Schrodinger's Gun. This is the one you mentioned, and this is going to be a treat for us, because the two of you are going to give us a little taste of what that show is about. Gladys, lead us into this show. What's happening? What are we going to hear?
So you hear a ticking clock, a dark room, a single light from above, and then these two characters start talking. We're not really sure where we are or what we're doing. And this is...
Okay. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and let you guys give us a little taste of this. This, again, the show, this particular show, Schrodinger's Gun. I'm going to step aside. Go for it.
Do you think of yourself as a good man?
What? I mean, yeah. Of course.
Dumb question, right? It's just that if you said no, we could skip the rest of this whole thing, but good. You got kids?
No, not married.
Ooh, that's still a prerequisite?
No, I guess. Sorry, why are we here? It's a little out of the way.
Privacy.
Right.
Yeah, because of what's about to happen.
Sure, yeah. And that's what exactly?
Exactly. You like this briefcase?
It's nice, I guess.
You think it's nice?
I mean, it's pretty beaten to hell, right? I mean, you wouldn't pay money for it.
No, probably not. Yeah, you're right. It's a piece of junk.
It's mine. Personally. What does that tell you about me? No. Keep it to yourself. Keep it to yourself. But do you know what's in this beaten up briefcase of mine?
No.
No. You don't know what's in this case. Could be a ridiculous number of things. Infinite, almost. But one thing it could be, amongst infinite, is another weapon. A gun. Right here. Now, chances are that it's not, that it's something else. But, I'll be honest, there's still that chance. Now, given that chance, I'm going to spell something out. If I open this case, and if there is a gun within it, it's safe to presume that I will use it on you. For real. Okay.
All right, so imagine that, and a clock is ticking. I'm about to fall off my seat. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Again, you heard actors Brian Reef and Javon Jacobs, and that was an excerpt from the play Schrodinger's Gun. It's one of the 8 short plays included in this year's Summer Shorts. We're also joined in studio by director and actress Gladys Ramirez. Summer Shorts running at the Arts Center through June 23rd. This is a powerful scene. My understanding, too, is that you, Javon, you play
a detective.
A detective. Yeah. And Brian, you're a recruit.
Yep.
A police recruit. Mm-hmm. And so now you put us through this moment. I heard that after the show, you had a showing this weekend, you got a boo. Yeah. A boo from the audience.
Yes.
A boo. It wasn't the whole audience.
Yeah, it wasn't.
It was a
specific patron. Yeah.
What happened? Tell me what was going on at that moment and what you were thinking.
I mean, it just kind of, things means we did our job, you know, we forced people to think about certain issues, yeah. And obviously it was a hot button issue, so yeah. To get that kind of reaction is a good thing, honestly.
Because I wonder about that, as an actor, it's like, you get booed, and it's like, but wait a second, I just did my best.
Well, Gladys? I think that speaks to the piece, and I think the writing and these two actors. The same patron also left a survey where they said they hated it and thought it was racist, which I thought was fantastic because that's what theater is about, right? Is like a reflection of society, and then that turns into the reflection of the people in society, which is also our audience. And they did such a good job of like so quickly capturing that moment that I was really happy about it. But if I could just really quickly say what you were saying about the actors going through so many shows quickly, it's really up to us as directors to really put them in that moment from the second the play starts. And we couldn't do that without all the costume design, without the lighting design, the sound design, to make every piece automatically click into place from the beginning.
So here, let me put you on the spot. So
sure.
These two guys finish that kind of performance.
Yep.
Now they're backstage. Anybody who's ever been backstage, as Javon said, it is hectic, chaos. Crazy.
It's crazy, yeah.
It is. Everybody's all over each other, and everybody's, you know. And
in
then,
the dark.
Yeah.
Thank you. Exactly. And then you're trying to get into your costume change and get ready for the next show, which is now a different show.
Totally.
Different characters. Yeah. So what are you doing to get them ready? What do? You go to Javon? Do you go to Brian and say...
My work finishes opening night, so I'm at home with a glass of wine at that point. But it's up to them and the wonderful crew, the wonderful interns, the wonderful stage management team to help them with those quick changes, turn them around, and do it all silently and in the dark.
Push you on for the next one.
Yeah, but as a director, what we really drilled, and especially with this piece, is we don't have flashy costumes or lights or musical numbers. We got to get into the moment from the start.
So, wait, is it true, Javon, you play in the very next show, you play a cow?
A dancing bull.
A bull. Very handsome.
That's variety there for you. It's a variety show.
Okay, hold on a second. You go from this intense detective.
Yep.
Threatening this other guy to a dancing bull. Okay.
That is right. That's summer shorts for you. Is summer shorts in a nutshell.
You know what, Gladys? I wanted to ask you about, you know, your favorite. What's, you know, of the different shows. Can I ask you that?
This one. Honestly. Because I haven't heard of a play that talks about police violence against Black citizens. And I thought that was so powerful, and to present it, I think Margaret Ledford, who's artistic director of City Theater, was really brave and hitting very on brave. All these social issues, yeah. And especially this one, in a lineup that is really funny, flashy musical numbers. So I think this one has to be my favorite.
And yeah. What's interesting about this is that this is you have a recruit, so this is like a training for the recruit.
Well, we're not sure.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I mean, there's this intense moment. And right. You know what? And maybe I think I'm wondering why you got the response that you did from somebody in the audience. I mean, Javon, you're a Black man and Brian is a white man. And so you have this scene. And it was, I mean, just for the minute and a half you were doing it, you know, it's uncomfortable.
It is.
But you wanted people to be uncomfortable.
You want them to think about it. You want them to think.
You know what? The other thing I was thinking about with the shorts, and I'm wondering, what is the appetite right now for theater goers? What do they want? Do they want long form? Do they want the long show, the full experience? I also know there are other groups doing these shorter little plays. Do they like that? What's right now? What's happening with theater goers? What are they asking for? Gladys, I'll start with you. I want to hear from everybody, though.
I think the future is shorter. Shorter formats, short plays, like what Micro Theater is doing as well.
Why?
Because you got to evolve with the times. Newer audiences, younger audiences have that shorter attention span. They want more of that content, and it provides a variety. So if you hate something, it'll be over in 9 minutes.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. You know? And if you love something, I think it's a gateway. It's a gateway thing, you know? You see a short, you like it. It's not so bad. I thought theater was stuffy. And then you show up and you see a long show.
Brian, what do you think? Is that true? Or is it just attention span? People are just...
Definitely, I think, attention span nowadays with social media, with everything. But I think, I mean, my roommate, when I did shorts 2 years ago, it was his first time ever in a theater. And now he's excited to come back to the theater because, you know, we gave him that like little dose of theater and what he likes, you know, and he realizes it's a form of entertainment that he can get into.
What about for actors, though?
For actors, I think it's just fun for actors. I mean, you just get to bounce around and do every single style possible.
And you get to play roles that you wouldn't usually get to play. Especially in summer shorts.
But you know, when you think about actors, though, I'm curious, like, for opportunities and employment, I mean, is that better? Is it better to do the shorts? Is there more opportunity with that? Or is that just where, I mean, you know, again, as you said, that's where we're going. Theater goers want
you don't
that.
Get paid by the minute.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Then you'd be in trouble.
Yeah. Exactly.
So real quickly, Gladys, if people have never been, as Brian just said, his roommate had never been to theater before this, what do you tell people about what to expect, what the summer shorts experience is?
Oh, man, it's
exciting. How should you approach it?
For first-time goers, grab a drink, grab a seat. You're going to have fun. Don't go in with a preconceived notion. Just be ready to laugh and to think a little. Yeah.
And as we heard, you know, from the short play that we got just now from Brian and Javon, it could be intense, but it could be fun because Javon plays a dancing bull after that. It could be fun. It could be funny. It could be a lot of different things. Again, Brian Reef and Javon Jacobs, actors that you're going to see in the summer shorts at the Arts Center. Gladys Ramirez, a director of these two shows, a couple of these shows, also an actress. The summer shorts runs at the Arts Center through June 23rd. Brian, Javon, Gladys, it's been such a pleasure. Break a leg. Have fun.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And check it out. If you have, we'd love to hear from you. You know, your experience at Summer Shorts. Find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. Let us know your experience. Tell us what you think. Well, that's Sundial for this Wednesday, June 5th. I'm Luis Hernandez.
I'm Danny Rivero.
Thanks so much for listening.